up, everybody? We are back, Necromaniacs Volume 7. Took a little break in November. We are back for December. You're with Mr. Mike Hill and me, Mike Scandato.
Howdy.
We are going to talk about a movie, first of all, that has been getting a ton of hype on Facebook and Twitter, and just, you know, generally tons of good feedback and good word of mouth, the Australian film The Babadook. It was directed by first-time director Jennifer Kent. It's an Australian film, by the way, which is of note. And it came out around May back in Australia. It did extremely well and hit U.S. theaters actually on November 28th. But it is available on iTunes and Amazon as a rental.
That's how I saw it, actually. It was on iTunes.
Yes, I saw it on iTunes as well. One of my, you know, the first questions I get, well, people who have seen the movie ask me, like, oh, did you think it lived up to the hype? Because it is a rare thing where, you know, a straight, you know, legit horror movie is pretty much being showered with good press, not just in the horror community itself, but on the outside of the horror community as well. And, yeah, I mean, I've seen this gather some, you know, mainstream blips here and there, you know, YouTube trending, Google trending, things like that. So that's got to be pretty damn cool for Jennifer Kent for a first movie.
Yeah. Then after that, we're going to segue into an interview we did with Mike McBeardo McPadden, the author of Heavy Metal Movies, which is available from Bazillion Points, the outstanding publishing company that Mike and I both have probably at least 3/4 of their catalog
between
the two of
us. Absolutely. They've put out the death metal book, Choosing Death. They put out the Swedish Sensations books about the Swedish exploitation films, Sound of the Beast by Ian Christie. I mean, just tons of cool stuff. They have the new New York Hardcore book, 1980-1990, coming out. So it's a book publishing company that I would gather that a lot of you out there listening are familiar with.
Yeah, Mike McPadden is a native New Yorker, sort of, you know, lived through the whole heyday of 42nd Street, Times Square, exploitation, you know, sort of environment.
Yeah.
And, you know, the book, definitely if you're interested in that sort of stuff, like horror movies, exploitation films, you know, creepy sci-fi, as well as, you know, heavy metal and how all that stuff fits in, this book is definitely up your alley.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and it touches the movies that have heavy metal moments, like, say, River's Edge or, you know, Airheads from the 90s. But it goes way further than that. I mean, it'll talk about Conan and Terminator and Suspiria, and it just kind of covers a very large spectrum of stuff. So,
and also just this, the voice, you know, his voice in the writing is like really entertaining. And, you know, most people, I think, if you're listening to this podcast and if you like metal or whatever, you'll definitely be able to relate to it. So it comes highly recommended from us.
Yes, it's a big, nice, thick book. Probably makes a great gift.
Yeah, 5 burning skulls from Necromaniacs.
Oh, yes, we give it the full approval.
Mm-hmm. All right, so let's talk about The Babadook.
Mm-hmm.
Number one, I thought it was pretty killer. Yeah. You know, I was reading a lot of stuff online about it. People were recommending it to me. And frankly, when I saw it on the cover of Rue Morgue, mm-hmm. I wasn't quite sold on it because I was like, oh, you know, it looks interesting, but I don't know if it was really the kind of movie I wanted to check out. But then some, you know, really, really high-level people, you know, my friend Ralph Schmidt from Planks recommended it to me, and I said, if Ralph likes it, I better check it out. So I rented it on iTunes, and I think it pretty much, for the most part, lives up to the hype.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there are movies that'll come to mind when watching it. I mean, three movies came to my mind while watching it, the first being Repulsion, the old black and white movie about isolation and depression among a young woman, Roman Polanski's Repulsion, and also The Shining and Nightmare on Elm Street, because this movie has a stake in that your dream state and your nightmare state when, you know, the Babadook appears, so to speak. And also, I just feel like it's great to see a horror movie get a lot of, like, props again, don't you agree?
Yeah,
I mean,
totally.
That is one of the cool things about this movie. The performances, woman Essie Davis as Amelia, the main character, the mother, And the child in the movie, Noah Wiseman, who plays Samuel, I mean, give this kid a nomination for a Best Supporting Actor. I feel like he did a fantastic job as a kid that is really struggling with seemingly some mental illness, horrific dreams, and just, you know, the movie, it gets pretty bleak and depressing.
Yeah.
Like, I would say. Would you say?
Definitely. There's like a bleakness and a sort of depressive element to it. What's also interesting about the film is that it's actually her first movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
and it was
ever.
Based on a short that she produced a number of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing was funded 100% by Kickstarter, right?
Yes. This movie, they raised over $30,000 for this movie. And, you know, I don't think the movie was 100% dependent upon it, but a lot of it went into, according to the notes, I have the special effects of the film. But, you know, I mean, we went to Sundance, and I think that's when the ground level kind of work was put in. And then in its home country in Australia, did phenomenally well. And actually went to the UK in October and the US, like I said, in November. And, you know, there's commercials for this movie. And there's a big online presence. And who knows, you know, what we'll see is the outcome. I'm sure, I believe January, February is the home video release. I'm sure it'll do extremely well, you know. But I just feel like, again, it was just very cool to see, you know, a horror movie gain a lot of momentum and steam. I feel like it's been a little while since we've seen that happen out of the, you know, underground kind of, so to speak. So, yeah, very, very, you know, excited and happy to see that.
Yeah, so basically the film is about, you know, a single mother and her son. And the father was killed in a car accident.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, obviously that had a very, very lasting, deep impact on their mental stability. And neither one of them seemed to have fully recovered from that incident.
Yeah, and it's reminiscent of Inside, actually, because the husband is killed on the way to the baby being born, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And the French film Inside, you know, has some slightly similar scenario where the husband, the woman's pregnant, the husband dies, you know, beforehand. But, yeah, it's definitely, it's not a happy film.
No.
it's not a feel-good film. But I wouldn't put it in the bleakness of, say, your Martyrs just yet.
No.
It's more scary than it is gory and bloody. I'll have to say that. It is a scary film, not a gore film, not a, you know, like porno, like, you know,
it's not like a torture porn film or,
torture
porn, zombies or anything, you know, like, you know, aliens or anything like that. It's like very much, I'm going to say supernatural, but even that is debatable.
Yes.
You know, there are some factions that believe that there was absolutely no supernatural element in this film, that it was all this, you know, dementia kind of mental breakdown sort of film.
Yeah, like she definitely is depressed and the child is depressed, the two of them. And you see them throughout the movie. I mean, the kid has a lot of very bad episodes throughout the movie. And the mother is just doing her best to deal with them. And then she has her own kind of episode. So some people are saying that the Babadook and, you know, the monster, or whatever, this thing doesn't exist at all. That this is literally all in her head and in the child's head. But then there are others saying that, no, that this was a real – this happened to them and drove them to the madness, so to speak.
I'm of the school of thought that the anxiety and sort of mental energy that was going on between them sort of manifested this thing.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Babadook is actually a, what you were saying, it's an anagram for a bad book.
A bad book, yes. That's how she came up with it, which is pretty damn cool.
Yeah.
And we don't know why or how this book appears, really. There's no real explanation for how it shows up in the child's library. Every night she reads to her son and picks out a different book, right?
Yeah.
And this book is one of the books that kind of comes into the rotation, and we have no idea why.
That was actually one of the creepiest parts of the movie, I think, is when she's like trying to, you know, give this kid, like, you know, a good night, you know, book reading kind of trip. Mm-hmm. And she's reading this thing, and with each page, it gets more and more extreme.
Yes, the words she reads out loud, like when you're watching the movie, you hear what she says, and yeah. She's kind of, you know, oh my God, I'm not going to, you know, yeah. Hold back a little bit for my kid, and it gets brutal.
And the kid's like screaming and crying, and she's like, oh my God, like what, you know, this kid's going to have, you know, not be able to go to sleep and have nightmares and all stuff. And it's a pop-up book too.
Yes, it makes it worse. It's a pop-up book.
Yeah, there's these like, you know, dark, you know, creatures and hooded menaces that
coming
are
to get you yeah. while you're sleeping. And
yeah, it's exactly not the book to read to a kid before he's going to sleep.
Nope.
You know?
Or maybe even yourself. I mean, I got to tell you, it definitely stayed with me a little bit. And some scenes were indeed scary. Yeah. And I feel like it takes a lot to be scary and have no blood and gore. You know what I mean? And no kind of over-the-topness. And I really have to give that to this movie because it seems like it's so hard for a horror director to do. Like, a lot of people are coming out of horror movies and saying, like, it was good. I wasn't scared, but it was good. Like, you know what I'm saying? I feel like I hear that often.
Yeah, you can recognize a movie as being well done without actually physically, you know, experiencing fear, you mm-hmm. know. But in this case, I felt unsettled, you know. Yeah. There's a lot of parts that were like, you know, and there's a, and we're going to give away the ending. I don't give a fuck. You know,
yeah, I mean, spoiler alert. It has been out a few weeks.
It's been out for a while. Like, you know, if you found it, good for you. you know, if you're listening to this podcast and you want to watch it, you know, still check it out. But
right.
I feel like I have to talk about the ending because the ending is like one of the things that really sunk the hooks in for me. Mm-hmm. Throughout all this whole thing, you know, obviously the death of the father/husband played a huge part in just the whole mm-hmm. drama in this film. And what I took away at the ending, it's almost like they reconciled this spirit and banished it to some sort of the basement.
The basement of the home, yes, correct, yes.
And there's a jump in the end of the film to like a few years down the line, and this my feeling is that the Babadook entity was actually the ghost of the father,
you know,
or somehow related to that. And
I can get behind that. I mean, that definitely could be part of it, because after some horrible stuff that goes down at the end of the movie, they seem to be finally okay, the mother and child. And they're not they look a little more normal. They seem a little more normal. They're smiling, they're laughing. One thing I've noticed is that they're celebrating the son's birthday finally.
Yes,
which they never did because it was a dark day and the husband died and blah blah blah. They seem to be at peace with that. I mean, there's so many different ways you can take it. The film, and maybe the creature is the father, the spirit of the father. Who the hell knows?
Yeah.
There are no explanations, and which is good. And I mean, sometimes you don't need an explanation in a movie like this. And that adds to like the atmosphere, you know?
The only thing, and this is even makes it more disturbing, is how the spirit is still vaguely hostile at the end.
Yeah, he's not, it's not like he's a good guy all of a sudden. Right. No, it's definitely, yeah. I mean, when you see the movie, you could probably get what we're saying a little better, but it definitely seems like, no, maybe not everything is all great. I know what you're saying.
Yeah. But then again, on the other hand, and this is why I like the movie, because I'm thinking about this stuff, is that maybe this is the creature, spirit, entity, whatever, ghost, is actually this like malevolent being mm-hmm. that they captured and is still haunting the basement mm-hmm. of the house. And they've decided that it's actually the spirit of their father or something like that.
And that they're okay with it, and that it's not ruining their lives anymore, but if it's relegated to maybe just the basement and just stays down there as the dark secret, maybe, yeah.
Because if you notice at the end of the film, they give it a plate of worms.
Yes, like a gift or like a meal almost, right?
Yeah.
Like as like an offering.
Yeah, and that's what really – the climax of the film was really what got me thinking, and that's why mm-hmm. I like the movie, because like, there's no cut and dry ending. There's really no explanation, and they just leave it open ended for you to mm-hmm. sort of project what your ideas are.
Right.
You know. Absolutely. Did you read the article in Rue Morgue about it?
No, because Rue Morgue has become increasingly harder for me to get. Midtown Comics gets, I don't know, three copies of the damn thing. By the time I go there, it's gone. I need to put it into my hold list or something.
Yeah.
So I've missed several issues, unfortunately.
I had it in my hold list, and I actually I got skipped 1 month.
See, that's the thing. Yeah, I don't know. It used to be very easy to find in America. I don't know. Maybe something's up with printed publications from Canada to the U.S., but it's getting a little harder to find Remark.
I stepped it up, and I actually got a yearly subscription.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, so now I get sent to my house every day. See, every week, a month, rather.
I need to dip into those waters myself.
Yeah. And actually, you save money on that. It's cheaper. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, I mean, Remark, though, my favorite, hands down, horror magazine. It's excellent. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a little pricey, though.
Yeah.
Primarily because it's coming down from Canada.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, but you save a little bit of money on the subscription.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been on board with them for years. I get a lot of info from them, and, you know, I have tons of them. But, if we go by your thought of what you're saying about the ending, then we could almost go with, oh, no, this really happened, and this is a real spirit and a real monster.
Yeah.
The ending throws a curveball to the whole everything is in her head in a way.
I think so.
It does, unless she's just doing that to appease her inner her inner demons. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's just, you know, it's really, it's open to interpretation.
To me, I never once thought that it was in her head, just because, you know, at the end, she goes in the basement. Mm-hmm. There's this entity down there, and it grabs her. And I'm like,
yeah,
I guess that could have been, like, some projection of hers, but... You know, being literal with the film indicated to me that the thing actually existed. So,
Well, as I said earlier, the public at large seems to like it. It has a certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes, 8.2 out of 10, which for Rotten Tomatoes is pretty damn high. 87 out of 100 on Metacritic, again, very high for these types of things. And one of its best... quotes is probably from William Friedkin himself, who said, "I've never seen a more terrifying film than The Babadook. It will scare the hell out of you as it did me." This coming from the man who has my number two greatest horror movie of all time. Well, that kind of put me over the top to put the damn rental down and see the movie. So,
yeah.
Of course, some people, you know, who don't think The Exorcist is one of the greatest horror movies of all time, that might not mean much, but it meant something to me.
Yeah, since we have this interview coming up, we're just going to cover one film in depth, and I guess we'll talk about some of the movies that we've seen that we liked, or some, you know, TV shows, horror movies that we've seen since our last episode, and possibly in the future expand those into like full blown analysis. I guess
right. So for the rest of the podcast, we're going to give a bit more annotated versions of what we've seen and what's been going on.
So I saw a movie called The Beneath. Mm-hmm. It was on – I read about it in Roomorg, and it was on Netflix. And it came out in 2013 and directed by Ken Kitai and written by Patrick Duty. Mm-hmm. That's the guy's last name.
Duty. Mm-hmm.
And it was an underground – it took place in a mine. And once again, it was kind of this thing of like – Are there the miners being possessed by this spirit, or just going crazy out of being cooped up, you know? And it had a sort of one of my, you know, another great film, The Descent, which took place underground.
Yes,
it had similar claustrophobic sort of, you know, vibe to it. But I give that movie like maybe out of five, a 2.5 though.
Ah, okay.
You know, is it
an all male cast? Is it mixed?
No. And this is the thing. It's like, you know, nothing against women. I love women, but it had a female in the mix. Mm-hmm. And I think that like, you just don't see too many women interested in mining. You know what I'm saying?
Probably not. I'm gonna say it's a male dominated world of employment.
You know, and the setup was like she's, you know, becoming an attorney. Like her father is, an OG, like coal miner. Mm-hmm. And she's coming back home, you know, and she's in environmental law. And then, you know, there's like this sort of dare and she ends up going down underground with the crew. That whole thing, it seemed very unbelievable to me. Hmm. You know, and that's not to say that, I mean, you know, to enjoy horror movies, you have to make a pretty big leap of faith most times, you know, just. You know, zombies.
Right.
You know, but you know, it was one of those things where it was a little hard for me to bite off the setup of the film, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they go underground. You know, there's this sort of indication that maybe there's a secret sort of compartment, that there are caverns they break into, and that the souls or ghosts of a you know, another group of miners that was trapped down there, maybe possessing them to do these violent acts against each other. Hmm. So, I mean, it's like an interesting setup, had a lot of potential, but ultimately it didn't, it kind of left me like wanting more, and I wasn't happy with the, you know, the resolution of the whole thing. Hmm. Okay. And once again, it played that sort of, card of, are these guys just freaking out because they're locked, they're like buried, you know, alive, or is there actually some sort of supernatural element to it?
Ah, okay, you that's know? Cool. I mean, is any hints of My Bloody Valentine in that mine? No,
no, no, that like that? No, there isn't like a, you know, a guy, you mm-hmm. know.
Okay,
it's like each one of them start to sort of, you know, fall apart right. a little bit, huh. you know.
Okay.
But it had its moments, and though, you know, it's on, if it's on Netflix, so it's not, doesn't cost you anything, you know, really, if you just go and watch it. So I wouldn't go rush out and watch it, but if it's like a Sunday afternoon, you know, mm-hmm. and you're just like got nothing going on, mm. you know, check it out, you know.
That's cool. Now you saw it on iTunes or
I saw it on Netflix.
Netflix, okay. Yeah so, I think it's come across my crawl. So that's pretty cool.
I would check it out. If you got nothing else going on.
Right. One of the movies I watched fairly recently on Netflix is a revenge film called Blue Ruin. It's an American film directed by Jeremy Saulnier. Back in 2007, Jeremy Saulnier directed a movie called Murder Party, which I believe was shot in Brooklyn. And it was kind of like an underground kind of hit. I'd read some stuff about it. I'd never seen it. It was one of those movies I'd meant to see, but I never got around to it. But anyway, a good 6-year absence, I guess, from the director of making films. And this Blue Ruin is another crowdfunded movie, actually. And MTV.com called it the perfect example of what crowdfunding can accomplish, because they gave the film quite a high, you know, they gave it a lot of love, basically. This movie premiered in Cannes in May of 2013, but it didn't come out in the U.S., you know, indie theaters until this past spring. This did show at Nighthawk, actually. I remember wanting to go see it just based on the trailer that I'd seen on YouTube, but I never got around to it. So I watched it a few weeks back on, you know, Netflix. Basically, the crux of the story is Dwight Evans is a vagrant, living out of his car in Delaware, you know, down on his luck, going through dumpsters for food and money. A policewoman finds him in his car and gives him the news that the man who murdered his parents, a guy named Wade Cleland, is about to be released from prison in his hometown in Virginia. Again, you don't get a lot of information up front about this movie. You don't get a lot of information about the drifter, about you know, who this man murdered, or, you know, what the revenge is for specifically, which is kind of a good thing and a little bit frustrating in a way to the viewer, but it kind of plays itself out as the movie goes along. He makes it down to Virginia and ends up finding out where the guy is who just got out of prison and stabs him. And this is very early on in the movie, in like the neck, in a restroom. In his temple. It's pretty sick scene, wow. Actually. Yeah, very surprising out of left field as you're watching it. While trying to escape out of the bar, he realizes he left his car keys in the restroom with the body. So he's forced to steal a limousine. The guy's family has a limousine company. And he realizes there's someone in the limousine in the back, and then lets him, you know, kicks him out or whatever. The thing is, as it all unfolds, you're, as a viewer, you're not sure, like, you know, well, why is this so important? Like this, you know, that he has to kill members of his family. Like, what did he do? Like, you know, what did the guy's father do to get him so upset? Basically, it almost plays out like a Hatfield and McCoy kind of thing where, you know, things were done by one family member to another family member and then vice versa. But somehow, this the main character, Dwight, as a result was so affected by it that he's, you know, like a homeless person. But he manages to, you know, find his sister. And basically, without, you know, giving everything that goes on in the movie away, it has a lot to do with, like, family secrets. And, you know, holding in these secrets and what, you know, terrible things that can come about as a result of secrets. And I don't know. I just feel like it doesn't play out like, you know, like I Spit on Your Grave or Last House on the Left. It's not like a deep horror element, but it does have this kind of disturbing realness to it. And that you'll be able to relate to the main character. A cool thing at the very end of the movie, there's 12 minutes left in the movie. And Eve Plum from the Brady Bunch is one of the family members. Yes, it's a very nice character. It's a pretty gritty character, actually. Huh. She's only in like the last 13 minutes of the film. When I looked on IMDb and saw the cast, I saw her name. So as I'm watching it, I'm waiting for her to appear. And the movie is literally almost over. And then she's at the very end of the movie. Great, great little cameo from her. But yeah, I mean, again, it's a very cool revenge movie, but it has kind of like indie movie dramatic elements to it as well, and not a lot is spelled out for you. You have to kind of really pay attention. There's not a ton of dialogue in the first portion of the movie. It's kind of the guy is kind of homeless, and he's getting himself together, and he goes to visit his sister. He lets his sister know that the guy who killed their dad is getting out of prison. It almost reminds me of like a 70s movie in a way. Maybe even in the family of like the movie Drive, where there's not a lot of talking up front, yeah. You know, but there's action going on.
Huh.
I can compare it to that, you know, kind of just like not artsy fartsy in a way, but just kind of indie in its spirit, because obviously it is an indie movie. But I don't know. I recommend it. I thought it was a very cool movie. I think you would like it, Mike.
I have it in my queue, yeah. Actually.
I think some of our listeners would like it. It's not really a horror movie at all, but it does get very dark, and it's just a cool movie.
I recently, and I've been waiting for this to come available for a while, I checked out Kevin Smith's new movie, Tusk.
Yeah, now this is a movie that I feel like I didn't even know existed until like a month ago. And is there a reason for that, Mike?
Well, I'm a fan of his. I love Kevin Smith. Not a fan of his movies so much, but I just think he's cool.
Yeah, that's kind of where I'm at with him now. I like him now more than his movies. I loved his earlier movies.
Definitely.
But I feel like he's had quite a few missteps.
I liked Red State. I thought Red State was great. That was.
I still need to see that.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that one. And that's like a very different type of film for him to make.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a fan of his podcast. Like, I religiously listen to his podcast. And this film actually came from the podcast.
Okay.
Because someone was. There was a listener brought up this thing in England where this guy was looking for, someone to live in his apartment, to rent a room.
Okay.
All right. And, or rent a room in a house or whatever. And it had to do with this guy turning someone into a walrus. Okay.
Wait. This was a real conversation?
Yeah, but it was a troll.
Okay. You know? Okay.
Gotcha. And the whole thing got exposed, but there was this conversation in throughout several episodes of the podcast of, you know, someone trying to find, you know, like they read this ad in like a British, you know, paper or something. Mm-hmm. I'd have to go back and like verify all this, but I know that in the podcast they were talking about this thing. And so Kevin had this idea of like, you know, I want to make a film around this. It sounds good. You know, a guy comes in, you know, turns this dude into a walrus, like drugs him. The guy wakes up, his leg's missing, you know, that kind of stuff.
Hmm.
You know, like sort of like, you know,
Human Centipede.
A little bit of like hearkening to that. You know what I mean?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So, you know, he went out, put the money together, got Michael Parks to star.
Who's a pretty awesome character actor. He's pretty great.
Oh, yeah. You know, and he's been in sort of in a bit of a renaissance ever since, Quentin Tarantino put him in.
Yeah, you know, which
you
is
know,
great.
And he was in Red State. Now he's in Tusk. And, so yeah, so basically the film is about a guy who does a podcast, and part of his kick is like, it's actually funny. The podcast is called The Nazi Party.
Oh God,
like
Nazi Party.
Oh,
boy.
Okay, so you know, his thing is he goes around to these like interesting, weird places and investigates. You know, like there might be like a Bigfoot sighting or some crazy kid doing something. And he goes and like investigates that, and they talk about it on the podcast. He goes back, and his partner lives, you know, he's like the stationary guy, and they go through this whole thing. You know, he's got some like, you know, dime piece girlfriend, you know, she's like real hot, you know, of course he's like cheating on her. He's not a very good guy.
Okay. Builds up to what happens to him.
Yeah. So there's like a little bit of a comeuppance in here, you know, it's okay. This guy is like not such a good guy. And then he goes out to Canada to investigate this kid who they had some internet thing on, and he's on YouTube, like a lightsaber or something like that. So turns out that guy committed suicide, and while he's there, he goes into a bar and I just kind of glossed over that. The dude killed himself. So his trip up to Canada.
Oh, to meet the guy.
Yeah, he was going to go up there to meet the guy. Mm-hmm. He finds out that the dude killed himself and he walks in on the guy's, like, you know, funeral, you know.
Oh, wow.
Kind of weird, you know. Very interesting, you know, vehicle to get him into Canada. Like, I could have thought of several other ways, you know, to do that. But anyway, so he's like, fuck, I'm in Canada. There's nothing to do. I'm in, like, whatever, Manitoba or something. He goes to a bar. He goes into a bathroom, and there's an advertisement above the urinal that says, you know, I got tons of great stories, interested in renting a room. So it's, you know, the connection with the thing that actually, you know.
All right, they brought him there.
So he goes up, and, like, Michael Parks is this guy, you know, he has got this beautiful house and everything, and, you know, he's you know, a seafaring, former seafaring man. And he tells him a story about being shipwrecked, and the only friend and companion he had was this walrus.
Okay. I heard about this. Mm-hmm.
So his, I guess, for the last, like, you know, decade or several decades, he's been trying to make another walrus companion for himself. You know, so he's been luring all these people in, doing all this experimental surgery on them, and, you know. So this guy, you can see it, you know, he gets drugged, he wakes up, one leg's missing, and then he goes through this big process where he gets surgically turned into a walrus.
Now, some people have said this is Kevin Smith's attempt at torture porn. Is that pretty much what's going on here?
Not really. No? I mean, I wouldn't say it's a torture porn film. You know, there isn't actually any torture going on.
Do we not see certain things? Like, off screen, certain things are not shown?
Yeah, like, the transformation's not shown.
The amputations, like, et cetera?
No, okay. He just comes out, and he's this fucking rubber-suited guy in a walrus suit.
My God.
I wanted so desperately to like this movie, you know what I mean? Like, I love Kevin Smith. I want to support him.
Yeah.
But
did he make this kind of movie is what I'm thinking in my head right now.
I don't know.
Huh.
You know, in the last several years, he's embraced smoking marijuana, you know.
Yeah.
And
that's what maybe – see, you know what? There might be some truth to that, because I've heard other people say that, like, that he became a stoner later in life.
Yeah.
And that his behavior is different maybe from the Kevin Smith that we might have known, and maybe that's kind of showing through in the movies he wants to do.
I just think that, like, you know, that – maybe might have changed his creativity a little bit.
Possibly, sure.
But, you know, Red State was a powerful movie. That was great. And he was a stoner when he made that movie.
Now, is Tusk was crowdfunded, yes or no?
I'd have to research that a little
more. Yeah, I'm not sure. I feel like
I don't think a guy like Kevin Smith needs to crowdfund.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he's got enough. He has enough of his own money.
I would think
he does. Also has mad connections in the film world.
Now, one thing I do know about this is the cameo of his daughter and Johnny Depp's daughter has led to a movie about these two characters.
Yeah, Yoga Hosers. It's another movie coming out.
Is there a moment in the movie that good that you think it's going to merit a movie about these two characters?
Yeah, sure.
Interesting.
You know,
okay.
Yeah, whatever. You know, why not? Everyone's got a shot. You know, hey, man, you know, I got a dream, you know.
Hey, you know what? If I'm Kevin Smith, I make movies. I have a daughter. She's interested in movies. I'm going to help my daughter.
Fuck it, man. You know.
It is what it is.
Why not? You know? Mm-hmm. But I the movie had a lot of humor in it. There was like this dark humor. You know, there was like when you really sit down and think about this dude got turned into a walrus and he's never going to be able to be a human again.
And does it just kind of ends? Like he's with the guy and it kind of.
No, they have a big confrontation.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. At the end, he kills the guy. Oh. Michael Parks dresses up into the walrus and they have this battle. And
no.
Oh, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
And then he lives out his days in a zoo. He survived. You know, like Michael Parks is killed.
Oh, my God.
Our hero, quote unquote, survives.
Wow.
And he lives out his days in a zoo.
And now, this is a feature length film. How long is it?
Hour and a half film.
Wow. And, yeah, I have to see this now.
It just was totally absurd. I downloaded it.
Does
from
it
iTunes.
Bear any mark that as you're watching it, say you're watching it and you don't know Kevin Smith is the director, does it bear anything that you would, that like, that has his
oh,
stamp
yeah.
on it?
Yeah,
really?
Definitely. Yeah. Oh. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like, you can tell he made the film because the humorous parts of it are definitely his humor.
Okay.
You know, he loves Canada and hockey and there's a lot of Canadian stuff
wow.
in there.
See, because now I'm hearing that he's saying that he's doing just a few more and he's done. But I feel like he said that already a few years back.
I want him to make more movies.
Me too.
You know, I like the fact that he made this movie because it is out there. Mm. And I think that it's cool. I don't think that, you know, just because, you know, you don't have to like every single thing. You know, like some people don't like Cold Lake by Celtic Frost.
That's right.
You know?
But some people have learned to like that record.
I love that record.
See, you like it. There you go.
You know? Yeah. And I get like ridiculed by people and, you know, but I would be, I would be lying if I just went with the general consensus and said, I don't like that record because I do like it. So there you go.
Yeah.
I like Tears Are Falling by Kiss.
Oh, that is a great song. You know what? There's a whole bunch of Kiss post-makeup songs that are fantastic that people don't even probably even think about. So I'm with you on that.
But in general, people think of Kiss without makeup as being like the bad part of their career.
But as people who would listen know, that's not true.
So with that said, to me, Tusk is sort of like, like Kiss Asylum in some ways.
Solid hard rock record.
Yeah,
absolutely.
But I mean, you know, some people wouldn't like this movie. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like definitely not as powerful as like, you know, any of the Jay and Silent Bob stuff.
Right.
It's not as good as Red Scare, or not Red Scare, Red State. You know, but it's not my cup of tea. It's like, it's that thing, you know, it's like, it's not, you know, I don't hate it just because I think it's an interesting idea, but, there was not enough of one. It was funny, but it was horrible in some ways too. So it's like,
I'm very intrigued.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, like I said, see it, do it. You decide for yourself what you want, you know, what you're going to take away from it. Mm-hmm. The ending was like, this fucking guy is like living in a zoo, right? And his girlfriend, the dime piece, shows up with a fish. She throws it to him, and he comes out, and she's like, I love you. And the guy eats the fucking fish.
Wow.
And he's crying because he's never going to. You know, it has a real downer.
How are the visual effects?
Horrible.
Oh, it's horrible.
Terrible. That's the thing. Never once do you think this guy is a fucking walrus. He looks like a dude in a very cumbersome rubber suit.
Oh, my God. See, I would have thought maybe they threw some money and made it look good. Okay, I guess.
No, and that's my other thing. If you're going to make a movie, like, maybe he's like, fuck it. I'm just going to make this thing look absurdly, like, fake, you know? I don't know, man. Like, it just, I was excited. I'm like, oh, cool. It's finally out. You know, I've been waiting to see this. Oh, it's great. I'm going to watch this. So I put it, you know, set aside some time. I made some, you know, some coffee. I'm just going to chill and watch this thing. And about halfway through, I'm like, this is a fucking waste of my time, man. Mm. And I hate that I feel that way about it, but I'm just being honest.
Mm. Yeah, even the people you like the most, not everything's a home run. So.
Yeah.
Which brings us to Ty West, a great director. His latest film, The Sacrament, has been pretty divided. A lot of people, I've learned, did not like this film. I actually like this film. It basically, it came out in 2013, kind of made the rounds into early 2014. The setup is that it's an American found footage horror thriller. But in reality, it is pretty much a retelling of the Jonestown Massacre. Some of you of a certain age may know what I'm talking about when I say that. Others may not. In the late 70s, there was a preacher, American preacher named Jim Jones, who had this religious sect called the People's Temple, mainly based in California. He managed to get them all to come with him to Africa to have their own little kind of world in Guyana. It was basically like, you know, the quote-unquote a paradise and where people could live free and it was great and they got to worship with, you know, in this great environment. But no, it was actually quite the exact opposite. It was basically a front for what became a suicide cult.
Yeah.
Pretty dark moment in American history. There have been multiple documentaries about it. There was a TV movie about it back in the day called The Guyana Tragedy, the story of Jim Jones. It's from 1980, which is in the bootleg circuit. I don't think there's a legit DVD of that right now. Pretty crazy-ass movie. I remember the story. I remember the movie as a kid. I remember all this stuff all about it. You know, it, a very interesting story, to say the least. There was a PBS documentary about it about 5 years ago that had all the survivors.
That's intense, man.
That were on it and interviewed. It was
wow.
Pretty insane. Look, seek that out. But, well, Ty West had an idea, could do a movie called The Sacrament, but basically didn't credit any of this Jim Jones story in his movie. He basically kind of took that kind of basis and added a modern twist to it. The modern twist being that it's a found footage film, and an even more modern twist is that the group of people going out to investigate this paradise, quote unquote, are from Vice magazine, which I've learned if you read your IMDb boards like I do, and you search out movies, you know, you'll find that, boy, that upset a lot of people. Other people thought it was kind of a cool idea. Other people were like, ugh, what a turn off, blah, blah, blah. But we both have seen this film.
Yes.
And I have to say, I did like this movie. I didn't hate on it as much as I think I thought I would. The performances were quite good. It was shot well. I guess the one thing that didn't sit right with me was the absolutely no reference or anything at the end of the movie or in the credits or, you know, to mention that, no, this isn't really an original idea at all. This is based on something that actually happened. You know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I thought it was an interesting film. I liked it. You know, it was not a groundbreaking film at all, but I enjoyed it. I thought it was really well done. I'm like a very sort of dubious fan of the found footage, you know, sort of genre. But yeah, I think that there should have been some credit given to it being based on a true story and also referencing the multitude of other films that have covered that same story.
Yes.
You know, be it fictionalization or straight out and out documentary
stuff out there.
You know, and everyone, people need that stuff. They need to be credited, you know, especially my biggest beef is the quarantine films.
Yeah.
You know, how like Wreck came out in Spain and Quarantine is basically a note for note cover version of that song. It's like, you know, like, the actor is a little bit better looking, a little more Hollywood, like, dude, you know, guy's like ripped, dude, fireman guy. He doesn't look like a regular guy. He looks like a Hollywood actor. So it's basically Wreck in English with, like, actors.
Yeah.
Obvious actors in it.
A bit slicker.
Yeah, slicker production.
Both. Yeah, exactly.
I enjoyed both, but the thing that bummed me out is that it's definitely not you know, there was no nod to Wreck. There was no credit given. And that guy's idea, you know, I don't even know the name of the guy who made Wreck off the top of my head.
Yeah, exactly.
Which sucks, you know, because I actually really enjoyed that film. And, but yeah, like Quarantine is the same thing. Like, you got to give credit where credit's due, really.
Totally. The thing is, the other thing that if you're going to just completely ape a movie, change a little something about it. I mean, the one interesting thing is that there were probably more people left alive than dead, which was a bit of a change of pace
right.
for today's horror movies. At the end of The Sacrament, it was nice to see that some of our main dudes made it out alive.
Yeah.
But everything else about it was, even the way they killed themselves was the exact same way they killed themselves in real life.
Absolutely.
The poisoned Kool-Aid. It was the same exact thing.
Yeah,
I don't know. Change it up a little, right? Like, I've read what I believe to be is the script of Green Inferno. I read it a while ago. It's made the rounds, and while people were saying, "Oh, it's just Eli Roth making a note for a note remake of Cannibal Holocaust," it is not at all a note for note remake of Cannibal Holocaust. It is actually quite different. There is no found footage. He made a movie that, although no one's seen it, is a separate movie. It's just in the same genre. It's a jungle cannibal movie. It's not a found footage movie. It doesn't have the same ending. It doesn't have it's a different movie. The killings are different. You know what I'm saying? The sacrament to the guy.
Some sort of credit given, you know what I mean?
Sure.
So before we go on, I just want to mention that we actually know somebody personally that was in Murder Party.
Yes, the first film from the director of Blue Ruin, his name is Jeremy Saulnier. Yeah, in 07 he did this movie Murder Party, which I have not seen, but I need to see it now.
Yeah.
Yeah, a friend of ours is in it, and apparently a lot of Brooklyn people are in it because it takes place in Brooklyn.
Yeah, it was made out here. Yeah, Will Lacey, who plays drums in Battletorn, as well as Necrolytic Lust.
Syphilitic Lust.
Necrolytic Lust is a song by someone. Yeah, Syphilitic Lust. Okay, sorry about that.
Mm-hmm.
So going with the found footage thing leads me to another film that I recently saw is VHS Viral.
Yes.
Did you see that?
No, I saw two. I loved one and two. It's in my list of things to see.
I really liked one and two.
Mm-hmm.
I loved number two because there was that, you know, like a Jim Jones-esque thing going on.
They upped the ante on some of the skits. Absolutely. Yeah, there was a little. Yes, that's right. One of the stories. Yep.
If you haven't seen VHS 2, that one segment with the guy in like Cambodia or wherever, Thailand or wherever he was, that there's like a scene, like a section of that film where this guy is
like a cult leader.
Yeah. It's out of control. Yeah, that could have been its own like feature length film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I that's like one of my favorite things I've seen in a long time. But anyway, VHS Viral, very disappointing.
Now, what do they do different from one and two with this one? Is it the same setup?
It's basically the same setup. Okay. You know, there's this kind of like narrative that goes on behind the scenes with all these things.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing is, I didn't quite follow what the fuck they were trying to do. Though. That's the thing.
It's like the wraparound story.
Yeah, the wraparound story. I didn't really follow what the fuck was going on. It was like they're uploading video to the internet, and I don't know, man. It's just I got bored. Like I was watching it, and then I realized I was like looking at email and like text messages.
Is there a same series of set stories in this? So I could say three, four stories.
Yeah, yeah. Uh-huh. There was one. There's a couple things in there that were intriguing, like, but in general, it was well below the first two. You know, there was like one segment where this guy, there's like he opens up a portal to a mirrored reality, and it's the, you know, sort of version of himself, and they're both looking at each other, and they change places briefly. That was cool. That was a pretty cool story. Like the guy goes over into this weird other world of like he thinks, you know, it's like, oh yeah, you know, I'm just gonna change places, it's gonna be exactly like my life over here. But no, there's this whole other weird demonic twist to it, and that was interesting. I thought that was kind of cool. And then you know, the demonic guy steps over into his world and wreaks a little bit of mayhem over there too. And then they trade, they go back, you know. It's cool. That one was good. I thought that was cool because, like, you know, I'm very much into, like, this multiverse. I love anything about multiverses. You know, so that was interesting in that. There was another one where these, like, annoying, like, skateboarders go down to Texas. Mm-hmm. Or not Texas, to Mexico, rather. And, you know, they're trying to shoot a skate video in somewhere. And then there's, like, they happen upon this like, sort of ritualistic, you know, spot, and then these like creeps come out and they have to fight them and stuff like that. And that was like okay. It didn't go far enough, I think. You know, they capture everything on their little fucking GoPros that they wear in their heads.
Is it the same people involved as parts one and two? Is it three?
There's some of the same people, I think. I think. I didn't care enough about the film to really do any research on it. So this is all I'm talking on my ass right now. But That episode, it was cool. There were some cool, like, you know, creeps that showed up, zombie types, you know. There's like some decent violence in there, you know.
So overall, a bit of a ball drop from one and two.
Oh yeah,
yeah. It happens. It happens to a lot of the horror franchises. Yeah. Of course.
It was promising though, but I didn't care for it so much.
You know? Okay.
I'm sure there are people out there who love it. So, what do you want from me?
Can't like everything.
Can't like everything, Mike. Yeah. You know what I mean?
No, you can't.
You know, I like a lot of things, but you can't like everything.
No, I mean, I try to see as much as I can, and you know. But, yeah, not everything is great, you know? But yeah, I mean, it's been a crazy year. I mean, for me personally, and just in my life, and I've tried to keep as up to date as I can with horror. But you know, sometimes the real life prevents you from keeping up to date with horror, right?
Yeah.
And that's it's kind of what happened. But sometimes, you know, in the winter months, you stay home a little more often, and you have a little more free time. So
yeah,
I plan to keep more on top of what's going on. But it's always fun to talk about older movies too. I mean, every episode, there's at least something new, or at least one new item we have. It is fun to kind of rediscover old movies or take an old movie that you haven't seen and talk about it and how it affected you and things like that.
The couple of television things that I've been into recently is obviously for me, I love American Horror Story,
mm-hmm.
and the latest. The Freak Show mm-hmm. Series, I think it's been great. You know, I really like it. And you haven't seen any of them?
No, I've just season one. I really loved season one. I liked that it was, you know, there was a modern setting and the story. It didn't get as over the rails as seasons that have come after it had. You know what I mean? I mean, not that it was believable or anything, but it was just a little more. Yeah. I think I liked its overall story.
Uh-huh.
And then I watched about the first four of season two, and I just couldn't get into it. I couldn't get into the mashup of horror that was going on between the Nazis and the asylum and the aliens. And it was just season two I thought was terrible, which kept me away from seasons three and four. But I keep hearing that season four is great.
Season three started out good. It was like almost – I brought this up to somebody and they didn't know what the fuck I was talking about. But mm-hmm. I was like – season three was almost like X-Men meets like witches.
I know. It was like at the school setting
yeah.
and the dynamics of all the girls in the school.
Yes.
And was it that kind of like a school for gifted youngsters
yes.
kind of vibe
yep.
thing going
so
on?
It had, okay. And then, of course, there was like, you know, the dark side, mm-hmm. and, you know. But they lost the plot. It was too many episodes
mm-hmm.
and it just didn't really follow through the way I wanted it to.
Well, to me, I don't know. I feel like one of the greatest things for horror TV this year was a show that was only maybe about 40% horror, and that's True Detective.
No, that stands above.
Oh yeah, I mean, maybe more than 40% horror. If you really look, if you're one of the people that believes serial killer stories are straight horror stories.
Oh, 100%.
Yeah. So I mean, it's in a way it was a horror series. So
yeah.
I mean, that's hard to kind of beat, though.
Yeah. Stevie Nicks was in the third episode, third series, mm-hmm. third season, rather, which is pretty killer.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
She overstayed her welcome, man. It's like she was
okay.
She was in too, just a little too long.
Too much.
You know, she's
okay.
not an actress, you mm-hmm. know, and she's really, you know, whatever. But this new season.
Yeah, what has been likable about this season?
It's a tighter, it's the whole thing's tighter. Mm. It's like very, the storyline's a lot tighter. There's
okay.
less. There's no these crazy left field things going on.
Oh, okay.
It, to me, it's an EC horror comic book type of thing.
It has like an old horror vibe.
It's got a very, very EC horror vibe to it.
Oh.
You know, there's like there's some very, very creepy moments in it.
So there's none of the outlandishness subplots of, say, that season two that were going on.
No.
With aliens and
no, there's no aliens.
Right. Okay.
There isn't even a supernatural element to it.
It's just the freak people.
Yeah.
Just the people. Okay.
It's just freaks and like a very ghoulish. There's a ghoulishness to it because
okay.
You know, there's this guy and actually what's her name? Some actress that actually Evan Peters
okay.
is it's like his girlfriend in real life.
All right.
You know, they're actually trying to find oddities. You know, for like some high level inner circle of people who are,
okay.
you know, they want to have like, you know, the dead bodies of some of these things. So they're trying to, they're trying to like manipulate the circus.
Mm-hmm.
They killed a couple of them. You know?
Oh, wow. Okay.
So it's interesting.
So that's cool. You know what? Maybe yeah. I will check it out once it wraps and it airs, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got Michael Chiklis in it.
Yeah.
You know?
No, that's cool.
It's,
I mean, have they given word about what the next season is going to be or not yet?
Not yet. Mm. Yeah, but it continues to you know, be popular with people.
No, this season, I think it's done, from what I understand, very well ratings-wise,
yeah.
and it's just people like it a lot.
This is probably my favorite season. Next to the first season.
Yeah.
And I think that because it, you know, for me, because it has like that, you know, lurid like EC Comics vibe to it. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if anyone else believes that or feels that way, but I do. To me, it seems like an EC Comics like homage almost.
That's very cool. That sounds like something I would like to
check it out. Yeah. And let me know what you think, because I think they're definitely in that lurid sort of vein. You know, there's a lot of like gruesome murder and stuff like
that.
Did
you were you up to date on Walking Dead this year?
Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I have to say, I mean, this whole first half of this season had like maybe one episode I didn't like one slow episode. I mean, this was actually a very good first half. Well, some people are very upset about the killing of the Beth character, like very upset. They petitions to make sure she comes back. And
what?
Crazy.
How the hell is she going to come back?
Yeah, exactly. Who knows? Exactly.
As a zombie? You know?
Exactly. Right. No, like they could maybe say part of it was a dream. I don't know.
Oh, fuck that, man.
I mean, I don't think that was a low point of the season, killing her.
No.
Let's be honest. There's going to be quite a few more major deaths as the series goes on. Maybe people just thought because she's younger and she's this cute blonde girl and people just liked seeing her on screen. Who the hell knows? But there's a big contingent of people that are very upset about that. I was a little upset, but I don't know if I'm up in arms signing petitions to bring her back.
No. That's the beauty of Walking Dead and Robert Kirkman's vision for it, is that everybody's fair game.
Yeah.
You know, like in the comic book, major characters have been fucking killed.
Gone. Yeah, long gone.
You know?
And, you know what? I've enjoyed this first half of the season a lot more than, say, the first half of the last season. I don't know. There's something about the last season as a whole that I just felt that it was slow and boring. And then every time I would mention that on Facebook, people would attack me. So this season, I haven't really had anything to say bad about it. So I've had no attacks on Facebook.
Yeah, the first episode came out just banging.
No. Banging it out. It was good. You know? It was great. Horror television, I think, this season.
I loved it, man. I think it was great. It's back to, you know, actually, I was like, man, like in that last season, I was like, how much longer is this going to last? Man? But now this season.
Yeah, the government thing it went on forever and it did get a little boring, I have to say, last season. Nothing boring about this season so far.
Who's the hottest chicks on this?
Oh, well, what's her name? The one we probably agree on. The girl, the short-haired girl. Oh, my. Maggie.
Maggie, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Maggie's my favorite. Yeah.
Out of the whole season, who do you like the best? Out of the whole series.
The whole series?
Yeah, the whole series, who's the best?
I mean, I love Laurie, but, you know, Maggie's probably my number one.
I grew to like Laurie. Initially, I thought she was too thin for me.
Mm-hmm.
do you know, this is going to sound a little off, you know, Michonne.
Oh, she's gorgeous. I mean, but I feel like she's so in her character that you don't even, like, I don't know, part of me is not even thinking about, like, her romantically, I feel like, because of the woman she is on that show, and she's always on, and she's always, you know what I'm saying? I mean, they've shown some vulnerabilities, don't get me wrong, but she, to me, primarily is a character that is always killing. Like, oh, you know what I'm saying?
She's a killing machine.
Yeah. So it definitely makes it a little different. I mean, to put her in that romantic light, whereas Maggie has a love interest.
Yeah.
Has had one for quite some time, and we've seen tender sides of her. I know there's been more character development for Michonne. And I actually think maybe there's probably a lot more for her coming down the pike, possibly. Yeah. But, you know. Yeah, I mean, it depends on how you look at everybody.
Yeah, I think it just in the last like two seasons, I started really becoming very attracted to Michonne.
Ah, hey, good for you, man. who knows what they have in store? I mean, the comic has had some ups and downs and left turns. You know, I at one point thought that they would just kind of take plots from the comic. Now they're only taking like semi cues from the comic and doing their own thing, which is what they need to do.
Yeah.
If they said from here on in we're doing nothing in the comic, I would be fine, because you need to be surprised. You need, like, you know what I'm saying? Otherwise, every step it's ridiculous. So.
Well, because this whole this thing that they got into in this past season wasn't even in the comic.
No, it was only a it was only a partial thing of the Hunter. Like they they incorporated one element of one 5-6 issue arc about people who eat other people, living people who eat other people, and they put their own new spin on it, and it was really cool.
Have you been reading the comic?
Yeah, I punched out about 3 issues ago, but so I'm fairly up to date on the comic. Yeah.
There has been a couple of lulls in the activity, but I think now there's a new, you know, plot developing now.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, there's like massive different. I mean, you look at the comic now and you look at the TV show, totally, they're different trajectories.
Just like how, they're saying the DC movie canon and the DC TV canon are going to be two separate things, whereas Marvel has had the luxury, since they own all their damn characters, that S.H.I.E.L.D. is concurrent with what's going on in Captain
movies?
America,
oh, wow.
Avengers. Yes, it is. DC has Flash and Arrow. Fantastic shows if you read comics.
Okay, I need to watch those.
Oh, my goodness. You just – the joy those two shows bring me as a comic reader to see all these villains and characters on the screen. DC announced that they're going to have a different person that'll be Flash in the movies. That is not the kid playing Flash on a TV show. So it's like, that kind of sucks, but they're keeping those universes separate. But yeah, I wanted to say this actually as we wrap up, for comic people, if you're not watching Flash and Arrow, you need to start watching those two shows. You're getting to see Arsenal. You're getting to see Black Canary. You're seeing Deathstroke. You're seeing Captain Boomerang. You're seeing Captain Cold. You're seeing, I mean, it is so great. Like, it's like all these Firestorm,
Firestorm,
Reverse
really?
Flash,
okay.
Zoom. Like, everything is on TV. It is so great as a DC fan. It's so fun, you know? And it's done well. It's done serious. It's not campy. It's not goofy.
Cool.
It's serious. And it's played serious. And it's just so, like, exciting as a comic reader since I was a kid, you know? To see this now is like, wow.
So Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., mm-hmm. I haven't seen any of that either.
See, me neither. My brother John watches it religiously and has told me that, yes, it goes on at what goes on in the Avengers movies and all the offshoot Avengers movies is in the same world and same timeline as Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., the TV show.
Do you think Captain America or any of those guys are going to show
up on
that?
Thing. They did Terrigen Mist the other night. They did Inhumans angle.
Oh, wow, okay.
And they may be incorporating that into the TV show.
Yeah.
A lot of characters that you may have seen over the years in the Marvel Universe that were part of S.H.I.E.L.D., they're all on the damn TV show, my brother said. So that's pretty
cool. I have to check that out, too. One more, you know, just recent discovery is there's a BBC show called Black Mirror,
mm-hmm.
which it's on Netflix.
Okay.
2 seasons, total of 6 episodes.
Oh, sure.
You know, it's like a lot of the BBC shows are
sure,
short.
Yeah.
Outstanding.
Okay. I'll
it's
take it out.
if someone was to ask me what it's all about, I would say it's like the Twilight Zone, basically, like a modern Twilight Zone.
Oh, very cool.
You know, British, sort of like British feel to it, because obviously it's all, you know, British people. BBC,
Mirror.
You know, it's what I found interesting is I watched all 6 episodes basically in a row over the last couple of days. Is it has a lot to do with digital technology, social media, the internet, you know, sort of almost like a transhumanist like sort of thing.
Okay.
You know, it's like a very, very interesting show because of that. And, you know, how like almost social media is almost giving rise to like a whole different type of organism and how it sort of influences like what I'm going to call like the physical world, you know, like the meat world.
I tell you, man, these UK people put on some good shows. Huh?
Yeah.
Got to check this out. And one more thing I want to mention, Beyond the Black Rainbow, I had ordered the soundtrack that has yet to arrive, but I got an email saying it's on its way. Damn it. So
okay.
Hopefully it'll come this week. They had sold so many. They didn't anticipate the popularity of that coming out on vinyl, and they sold through so fast that quite a few people were left hanging in the breeze, like me and Mike. But apparently, the LP soundtrack for Beyond the Black Rainbow is coming out very soon to the people who ordered it.
Yeah, a while back, I got an email from them saying that you know, it was like
back order or whatever.
Yeah, also saying whether or not I wanted to cancel my order and get a refund. And I said, no, I want to. I'd rather wait and get it.
That movie still has legs. I still see people talking about like that movie, and you know, it's kind of I would imagine it's probably sold very well for a small movie at this point.
Yeah. I mean, I have the Blu-ray.
Yeah, me
and,
too.
I would like to talk about it, but I still don't know what the fuck it's about, so I can't really intelligently have any kind of, like, you know.
It's just, it's literally, it's like, if you're into David Lynch, if you're into Cronenberg, if you're into the whole early 80s weird movie vibe, synthesizer soundtrack weirdness, watch this movie. That's all I can say about this movie. Yeah. If you're into movies that you don't necessarily need to have, okay, here's the plot, here's the beginning, here's the middle, here's the end. If you can just kind of throw all that out the window sometimes, this is the movie for you. And just visually be stimulated, you know what I mean? Just,
yeah.
Just kind of take it in and just be like, you know, that's the kind of movie it is.
The this past Friday, you know, I live close to a rock venue called St. Vitus. Mm-hmm. And I was there on Friday, and they you know, there's like a area where they have like the show, and there's like an area where they have like people that can hang out and band set merch up and everything. They project a lot of stuff on the wall. Usually it's you know, old heavy metal footage like Judas Priest or whatever.
Right.
But when I was there earlier in the evening, they were playing stuff off of these like bizarre films from Netflix.
Hmm.
One of them was a movie called Zeta One.
Zeta One. Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm. And check it out.
Yeah, and I put it. I found it on Netflix, and I put it in my queue. And it's like, I don't know who made it. I'm going to research it. It's like very Roger Corman-esque.
Hmm.
You know, there's like sexy women in it. There's like, you know, like sort of spaceships and intergalactic travel. And the guy looks like Darth Vader. And, you know, it's like, then there's like a whole other element where on this like planet where there's like barbarians and everything.
Huh.
So maybe I'll watch it tonight.
Yeah, there
maybe
you
should watch it.
Okay.
Maybe we can talk about it or something. Yeah, it's Zeta awesome. One. Zeta One.
Yeah, so you know what? Sometimes, you know, you just want to, you just watch a movie that makes no sense or whatever. And, you know, I last night watched Christmas Evil for the first time.
Okay.
Horrendous. Yeah. It's from 1980. John Waters cites it as, quote unquote, his favorite holiday movie ever and one of the greatest Christmas movies ever. He loves this movie. Well, sometimes John Waters doesn't get it right. This is a horrendous, it's not even like a bad, it's not a cool bad movie. It's just a horrible, horrible movie. There's elements to it that are very kind of creepy and weird, which I'm probably one of the things he liked about it. And the ending is just bonkers, batshit, makes no sense, crazy, which is also probably what he liked about it. But the rest of the movie is just terrible. Synapse put it out, and I had the DVD for 2 years, never watched it. Watched it last night, Christmas Evil. It is not a good movie. So it is, I'll never watch it again. I mean, it has these little campy moments and these weird, creepy moments with kids and Santa. And it is about 2 or 3 years before Silent Night, Deadly Night. And this Santa does kill people. And his reasonings for killing people are almost somewhat similar for the reasonings of Silent Night, Deadly Night's reasonings. But they're very different movies.
Wow.
And Silent Night, Deadly Night is a way, way better movie. This is just a horrible, low-budget movie from 1980 that for some reason has a very bizarre following. So, yeah, Christmas Evil.
Well, once again, I just want to draw people to our Facebook page.
Yes, Necromaniacs has a Facebook page, facebook.com/necromaniacspodcast is one long word.
You know, try to get in touch with us through there. And also, if you're checking it out on iTunes, you know, leave a review, give us a star rating or whatever. Say you don't like it, you like it, it sucks, it's great, whatever.
Right.
But yeah, if, you know, feel free. And so yeah, we're gonna roll into this interview. See you next time. Power! So thanks again for doing this podcast with us.
Thank you. Thanks for being understanding about the other day.
It happens, believe me, I know. Huh. You know. So you're a native New Yorker.
Yeah. Born in Brooklyn, 1968. Cool. Grew up there. I lived there 33 years of my life. I'm 46 now, so.
Oh, wow. What part of Brooklyn, Mike?
I'm sorry, what's that?
What part of Brooklyn, Mike?
I was born in Park Slope, but I grew up in Flatbush over by Brooklyn College.
Oh, okay. I grew up in Sheepshead Bay, and I went to Brooklyn College.
All right. I went to Brooklyn College, too.
Yeah, I'm born in 73.
I also went to Kingsboro.
Me, too. Yep. So, wow, similar lives.
So, I introduced my wife to Rollin' Roaster 7 years ago, and we've been together ever since. So.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, great place to eat.
So, you have a pretty checkered past when it comes to writing, Mike. So, you want to give us a quick rundown of,
interesting word.
all the different, you know, you worked at Troma for briefly for 2 weeks.
literally 2 weeks. Okay. I started writing in the early 90s. I started publishing a zine called Happy Land that was just about me hanging out on the last, these were like the last days of 42nd Street Times Square is like an exploitation movie and slash professional orgasm providing center.
Yep.
And so that I did that zine, and then I got some attention for that and started writing freelance for a weekly paper called the New York Press.
Yeah.
And then Hustler Magazine came calling in 1992, and I went to work for them. Actually moved out to L.A. for almost 3 years in 93, and wrote for them, wrote some screenplays for esteemed adult film director Gregory Dark.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow, the Dark Brothers.
Very impressive.
Yeah. The one of the Dark Brothers. I wrote Devil and Miss Jones 5, which is like really a pretty good movie.
I actually own that movie.
Oh, yes. Look, Selwyn Harris right there in the credits. That was my name.
Oh, wow.
My pen name was Selwyn Harris, which was the final two grindhouses that remained open on 42nd Street.
Oh, very cool.
I also wrote an R-rated movie for him called Animal Instincts 3, which I believe is available on YouTube and is hilariously terrible.
I'll check it out.
And then I bounced around. I wrote for a lot of adult magazines while that was the thing. Back then it was kind of like an outlaw thing to do. And, naked women. So
yeah, everyone likes naked good. Women. Yeah.
And then in 97, I had developed a 5-alarm drug and alcohol problem at this point. So, late 90s, I was trying to get clean and, I wanted to scrub the porno off my resume. So I took a job in Troma and it lasted for 2 weeks. So
2 weeks.
Is it as bad as I say? I mean, I've known people who interned and worked there and nobody gets paid and blah, blah, blah. That's all I hear.
It's a meat grinder. I mean, they offer you no money and then they give you less than no money. So it's like, that was an example of me selling out because I think now Troma has done some great acquisitions in the past, like, a Combat Shock and technically Bloodsucking Freaks and Mother's Day or Troma films.
But, technically, yes. Yeah, Mother's Day is great from a few years ago, yeah.
But the splatter comedy crap, I just thought it was insulting and cutesy. I don't think Lloyd Kaufman's Mel Brooks impersonation is funny. and then, to me it's all this like, aren't we adorably bad? And it was like, well, you do that because you couldn't make a decent exploitation film. So you do this kind of parody of one. So anyway, when they offered me whatever it was, $5 a year, whatever my salary was, I'll take it. I'm selling out my principles. I'll take it.
Uh-huh.
I just walked off after 2 weeks. They actually offered me to write Lloyd's, to ghostwrite his autobiography. And so they draw up these legal papers, and it literally said on it, for the fee of $0.
Wow.
Like the number, like the written ZERO with the number next to it.
Oh, my goodness. $0. Jeez.
And I was just like, I can't do this. this is murder. So I walked off, which I'm not proud of. But, you know, that happened. Then I bounced around in the legit world for a while when the dot-com stuff was going on. And when that bubble burst, like I was writing for like Sting, the rock star, his official site. Man.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
And you know, that was kind of, it was interesting because I was like above ground and human for the first time. But then that bubble burst. I was like, you know what I miss? Just naked women and just doing that for a living. So I went back to work at a magazine called Celebrity Skin.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Of course.
Yes, yes.
And really worked ridiculously hard on that magazine for a year. And pun on hard, probably. I really, like, labored. I turned it into a pretty cool magazine. And I was, at the time, a fanatical Howard Stern fan.
Yeah,
both of us are too.
Yeah,
big fans of his as well. So,
and I mean, like, you know, like from 1982, I was 14 up until about 5 years ago. I just, the current version of Howard, like the Betho, the America's Got Talent. It's like,
yeah, it's quite a bit of a difference.
It's awful. But anyway, but you know, so Mr. Skin was a regular there, and I loved Mr. Skin. And one day we get a call that we also always, for the magazine, just would go to Mr. Skin and take his pictures and put them in the magazine. They did such a good job reproducing the pictures from the movies.
Mm-hmm.
So Mr. Skin being the world's foremost celebrity nudity site, Celebrity Skin being the magazine version of that.
Right. Makes sense.
One day we get a call from I had been doing some freelance work for, Shakorama.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Just writing some box copy for them, and Mr. Skin had run it. It was an actual guy, as you know from Howard.
Mm-hmm.
Ran into those guys at a trade show. Said, "This writing is really funny. It's good, and it conveys what the product is." Who is this guy? And they gave him my number. So I get a call from him one day, and he's like, "Hey, I'm in New York. Want to go to lunch?" So I was like, "Sure." So he comes up to the office, and my art director is scared shitless that he's going to start beating him up for stealing all the pictures off him. But so he walks in and goes, and he's like, "Look at it." He goes, "Did you get this from me?" And the guy goes, "I don't know." He goes, "It's fine, dude. I don't own it." So anyway, we had a good laugh. Skin ended up taking me to lunch and dinner. He got drunk and offered me a job in Chicago.
Oh, wow.
That was nearly 12 years ago, and that was a very good and fruitful relationship. That came to a happy close last summer. Worked there for 11 plus years and decided it was time to move on and just try to write books for a living.
So I have a question. Mr. Skin has an office?
Skin Central.
Wow, that's pretty great.
The heart of Wicker Park. yeah, it's an old firehouse with a pool table, a jukebox, a kegerator.
Wow, kegerator. Sounds like a nice place to work.
Yeah, it's a real fun place to work.
So that brings us to Heavy Metal Movies, your this book that we just finished reading here. And one of the things that's really most interesting about it to me is, you know, you paint this very vivid picture of, 42nd Street in old New York, which,
yeah,
as you know, is all but disappeared these days.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, you know, some of the younger kids who listen to this podcast or people that don't live in New York, can you sort of describe what that was like, seeing that firsthand?
It was an open-air market of sin, vice, and ultimately death, but really fun death. It was, it had always been, so Times Square, 42nd Street being, Times Square being the physical heart of the city, of Manhattan,
mm-hmm,
and 42nd Street being the heart of Times Square, had always been an entertainment district. When the city fell on hard times in the late 60s into the 70s, the entertainment changed dramatically. And it, you know, the theaters became either grindhouse theaters that were showing horror, kung fu, and softcore triple features all day and all night,
right,
or porno theaters. And then there were peep shows with live girls, and then there were massage parlors, which were just essentially brothels. And it was just the way things were. New York was lawless,
yeah,
up until, the early 90s. Mm-hmm. And it was just wild. I mean, as a kid, I always say, and this is the truth, a 12-year-old kid growing up, when I was 12, could walk into a bar and order a scotch and soda, and nobody would, like, blink an eye.
I tell you what, I agree. Growing up at Sheepshead Bay at 14, I walked into, you know, an old man bar on Sheepshead Bay Road and got a beer. So, yeah.
So, 100%. The Ashford Arms and all those Irish bars on Flatbush Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times, I swear to God, no one there was like had yet graduated high school. And so that was just kind of the time and the tenor. So, yeah, there were about a dozen of these grindhouse theaters, and it was just amazing because they were cheap and just stuff that didn't play anyplace else played there.
Right.
I went to Xavier High School on 16th Street and 6th Avenue,
mm-hmm.
which was two subway stops away from 42nd Street. And, you know, I was a lonely, weird movie fanatic kid, and I would go up to 42nd Street and just go into the theaters. It freaks me out now to think of a 14-year-old, you know, this white, chubby 14-year-old woman, which were just complete insane asylums.
Yeah.
Of just, you know, drugs and prostitution and just mania. I mean, just people freaking out over what was on the screen and what was going on in the seats all around them. But it was, you know, an incredible education for me and, you know, something that is gone forever.
In 1993, I was interning at MTV for the whole summer and I had to deliver tapes all over town, and that was when pretty much they almost were all gone, and a lot of the marquees of them had these weird artsy sayings on them. Do you remember that, Mike?
The worst thing that ever happened in the history of New York. Can I curse on you?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Go ahead. Go ahead, please.
Fascistic.
Yeah. It was a very strange period.
And she is allegedly an artist, and she writes these little, like left-wing slogans. It calls them truisms.
Mm-hmm.
So
I remember this.
The whole thing. Everybody blames Giuliani. Here's the thing. It didn't die under Giuliani. Giuliani brought it back as something different. Mm-hmm. 42nd Street, Times Square, died under Dickens. And that was largely, mostly because of home video more than anything else.
Right.
But it was also crack and AIDS and a general like, change in society.
Mm-hmm.
So most of these theaters were closed. So the city paid this fucking twat monster, Jenny Holzer, to put her stupid truisms on the movie arcades, which to me are like cathedrals, you know?
Yeah, it was
like somebody wiping a fucking tampon all over the front of my church. And, you know, but say stuff like, raise boys and girls the same way.
Yeah, it was very strange.
Surplus is evil.
Mm-hmm. I can feel my testosterone dropping just from you guys fucking saying this.
And then, like, some of them were almost like, I remember like hints of what was to come, like the Disneyfication and like the change that really was coming and that had already kind of kicked off in 93.
Yeah.
And
there was a little blossom of it in 93. And 93 was the pivotal year. That's when the last of them closed. Yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, I read the book Sleazewood Express by Bill Landis. And he actually says one of the last movies to play in 93, I forget what theater was Falling Down with Michael Douglas.
Oh, right, yep.
Yeah.
And how it was almost like ironic and like prophetic that was the last movie to play. A guy who wanted things to stay the way they were and wanted them the way they used to be is one of the last movies to play in the old Times Square. Kind of interesting.
The very last, so the Selwyn and the Harris were the last two, and then they converted the Roxy, which was a weird, really scary place. That showed VHS movies. It showed, like, Kung Fu films and then, like, Steven Seagal movies and Superman 2 would be, like, playing on a different screen. So
that was
an actual double feature I saw once. I didn't go in, but that was there. I had it written up there. But anyway, the Roxy became a multiplex at the end of the block by the Port Authority. And I had moved to L.A. in 93. I came back in October 94, and they were still going all night. So there was a 3 a.m. showing of New Nightmare, the new Freddy Krueger movie.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I was like, oh, I gotta go see that. So I had also, in the meantime, that I had stopped drinking and begging drugs. So stomach cold sober, I go into this theater at 3 o'clock in the morning, And I'm sitting there, and the crowd starts coming in, and I got petrified. I was like, oh my God, how did I ever do this? And I left before the movie started. I was like, no wonder I was loaded all the time. So I missed, that was my last Times Square movie experience of the classic era.
Wow.
So the heavy metal movies, like this book, you know, so it's sort of draws from that whole experience. What's the basic criteria of how did you select the films that appear in the book?
Yeah, I kind of came up with a formula, and it was like, okay, so what makes a heavy metal movie? So it was, okay, on the top, the top layer is real obvious stuff. So concert films, documentaries, automatically.
Mm-hmm, right.
So like The Song Remains the Same to, you know, something, The Diary of a Mad Band about the band Down, directed by Jim Van Bever.
Right.
Real obvious. Next, you have movies that are about heavy metal, about the music and its culture.
Yes.
So, that would be, you know, Spinal Tap, Airheads, anything like that. Then you have movies that contain heavy metal musicians. So Lemmy's in dozens of movies. So anything with Lemmy automatically. Mm-hmm. Then movies with heavy metal loving characters. So Wayne and Garth, Beavis and Butthead, Bill and Ted. And then you keep going down, and then it becomes, well, what about movies that just embody the spirit of heavy metal, that have been influenced by and have gone on to influence heavy metal, the music and the culture? And that's when you get to Conan the Barbarian, The Exorcist, Mad Max films, Blade Runner. And then basically whole genres kind of fit that bill.
Right.
So post-apocalyptic sci-fi, anything with Satan in it, you know, Cars, 80 slasher films, stuff that just kind of oozes heavy metal. You know, I know it when I see it. I hear it when, you know, I know it when I feel it, kind of thing. So that was my criteria for the book. And ultimately, you know, I'm the guy writing the book, so it's my call. So if I got some wrong, I got some wrong. And if I surprised people pleasantly, well, hooray for me.
See, that's great. I mean, I was wondering how you did it, because initially when I heard about the book and before I saw how big it was, I thought it was literally going to be about the, I don't know, 15 or 20 heavy metal horror movies that are out there. You know what I mean? Like, that's what I thought the book was going to be. And
Black
I was very pleasantly surprised that, oh no, it's way more than that. It embodies everything that you just mentioned. So that was pretty cool.
Yeah, it started actually, thank you so much. It started as a friend of mine named Eric Danville compiled, he wrote the Heavy Metal Book of Lists.
Oh, yeah.
He asked me to do one, and I did two. I did the 13 greatest heavy metal horror movies, which you mentioned. So that's like Black Roses.
Right, that's what I thought your book was going to be about.
Certainly they're in there.
Yeah, they're in there, definitely.
And then it was 13 greatest metal moments in non-metal movies.
Hmm.
So that was stuff like Twisted Sister and Pee Wee's Big Adventure.
Okay, yep.
Cameo appearances like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, and from those 26 movies, I just kind of built it outward. Another criteria that I forgot was titles. So, like, any movie that, like, Iron Maiden has, like, 50 songs that are based on movies.
Mm-hmm.
From, like, The Wicker Man to, you know, Phantom of the Opera.
Right,
to,
yeah.
I mean, so many. The Loneliness of the Long Distance Runner.
Mm-hmm.
So, they all made the book, too.
I read the book when I was out on tour, and, you know, a lot of people were asking me about it. Like, you know, they saw me reading it. They're like, well, what's this book you got here? And I said, you know, it's a book. It's got about movies. And so is it, like, heavy metal in movies? And I said, look, all right, you know me. You know what kind of guy I am. You know, don't have a lot of friends. I'm, like, into certain things. If you're like me, then this is your guide to a bunch of movies that you need to see. So that was kind of how I described it to people. You know what I mean? If you're into metal, if you're into horror movies, if you got a certain like outlook, you know, these are the movies that are going to appeal to you. And, you know, a lot of, I mean, you know, 60, 70, maybe 80% of the films I've seen already, but then there's like a 20% that I'm like, oh shit, I got to check this out.
Right.
So that's how I use it. Now I'm like going through the films I haven't seen. So yeah, it came out to be a really good resource for me.
Thank you so much. I kind of had the same experience putting it together. Where it was like a movie I knew would lead to, 10 movies that were attached to it somehow. And then I'd see a poster online. I'd be like, what the hell is that? And that director would have made some weird movie that lead to four more titles. So I discovered a lot of stuff in the course of this. And I'm a guy who's like devoted so much of his life to digging up old movies, but I learned so much while doing this film, this book.
One of the things that I think is cool is that Jim Van Bever is very, very well represented in this book.
And, we're big fans here.
Yeah, I think I think all three of us, who are coincidentally all named Mike, are huge Van Bever fans. Hmm. And I'm stoked about that because even if Van Bever is making a movie about gardening, it's still going to be metal as fuck. You know what I mean?
And an event and unique and unmistakably his.
We talk about him often. We'll have a podcast that has nothing to do with him, and he'll be talked about in the podcast.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
We talk about him a lot.
Have you met him?
I haven't, no.
I did in 2003 when Manson was showing in New York for a few weeks.
Right.
I did meet him, and I went to the show, and I even got a Manson family t-shirt that night. And he was really nice. You know, he spoke to the audience after the showing, and that was the one time I met him.
I did a similar thing. I met him when Manson showed in Chicago, just kind of said hi and, fan your work and stuff. But I had a previous experience with him. As you know, Jim likes to drink.
Yes.
He enjoys a cocktail. So I went to, it was a showing at the New Beverly. This is probably about 10 years ago. A good friend of mine is Dave Shulkin from the band Blood Farmers.
Okay, I know that.
And he's also the head of, he's one of the key members of Grindhouse Release, Cannibal Holocaust.
Yeah,
I know exactly what you're talking about.
So Shulkin and Van Bever are real tight. And I went to a screening of this really amazingly, mesmerizingly shitty movie called The Hollywood Strangler.
I haven't seen it.
It doesn't ring a bell.
It's awesome. Because nothing happens until the very last scene of the movie. And then that last scene is just mind-blowing. So anyway, I went to that, and Van Bever was there in like a white leather suit.
Yeah, he was wearing a suit when I met him, too,
In the middle of August or whatever, and he was like lit up, and he was in love with this movie. And I'm sitting a couple of seats over from him. I was like, I want to talk to Jim, but I'm scared of him.
Yeah.
So I just was like, I'm just going to enjoy the fact that I'm here experiencing this movie with one of my great cinematic heroes.
Yeah, that's, I'm a huge fan, but yeah, I'm a little intimidated by that guy, you know?
He's very, very physically and spiritually intimidating.
Yeah, and, like in that Deadbeat at Dawn, he did all those stunts, you know? He was, throwing, like, round kicks, and, you know, he's like a fucking physical motherfucker, man.
Yeah, oh yeah.
But that, the extras, like, there's some interview footage that's on the Manson, DVD. And the interviews with him are super powerful, like very, very inspirational of a guy who really had everything against him, like to make his films, like even making that Manson film. It took like, 12 years to make it?
Yeah, I mean, forever. Yeah.
Yeah. And, I remember reading about that like years and years ago.
Before, like 10 years before the movie, there was a book.
Yeah. And it just like for me, you know, just in general, like, you know, people like that, I always have like ultimate respect for, you know, who just don't give up. And that's like one of the coolest things about Van Bever, I think.
Yeah. He's relentless. And he really is an inspiration. And he's the type of guy I thought of like going through it. Because at some point, I'm writing this book, which is massive. And I ended up writing like 1,200 reviews and 850 made the final cut.
Damn.
But at one point, I'm like 6 months into it, and I'm like, because the original plan was to do 666.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
So about 6 months into it, I'm like, all right, I got to be about halfway through at this point. So I totaled up where I was, and it was like 100. Oh, God. But yeah. I just thought of like guys like Van Bever. It's like you just keep pushing through. You just keep going.
Another thing I'm excited about is Ricky Casso. The various films about Ricky Casso, who I remember when I was growing up seeing on the news.
Front page of the Daily News, I remember that.
That being represented, because not enough people know about that, late 80s satanic murder cult that was going on in Long Island.
And that movie, I was telling Mike beforehand, it actually has never come out. So it's only basically available as a bootleg, Ricky Six.
Yeah.
I've never actually even seen the movie. So, I need to do some more digging.
Well, what was really cool in doing the book, and again, you know, how anybody, like, ever wrote a book like this before the internet, I can't imagine.
Wow.
But I genuflected. Like, Michael Weldon, who wrote the Psychotronic Encyclopedia of Film, which has, like, 2,000 movie reviews in it from 1982.
Yep.
But, like, so, like, Ricky Six is an example. I'd go online and say, hey, can anybody help me out and send me a copy of Ricky Six, and I'll hook you up with a book. People would just email me the file.
Oh, wow.
Oh, wow. It's
cool. It's awesome. And that happened a lot. There were very few films I couldn't find.
That's cool. Yeah, I need to just do the digging myself, I guess. Or sometimes it pops up at a, you know, horror convention, you know, on a bootleg table. Right.
Yeah.
Another really notable fun fact in this whole experience is that a Serbian film was included, which is actually episode one of my other podcast, Everything Went Black. Mike and I, we had just seen it out in Bay Ridge in a legitimate movie theater.
Yeah, for some reason, the Alpine.
Did you play at the Alpine?
Yes, it was at the Alpine for 2 weeks. 2 weeks it played.
I know this really wacky goth chick that lives up the block from the Alpine, and like she thought it was like a weird sign from like the devil that served from.
Yeah, we were. There was about five or six people in the theater.
Oh, I don't even think there were that many. I think there was me, you, and
like two other friends.
Two other people.
Yeah.
And then like a couple was sitting behind us. And I remember like several rows back, there was a couple, a guy and a girlfriend, you know, a guy and his girlfriend. And midway through the movie, I glanced back and they were gone.
They
tapped out. They tapped out midway through.
They
so.
Were probably just like Serbian immigrants, you know.
Yeah. But that's, you know, that was special to me that was included in there.
Yes.
Episode one of our, you know, my other podcast.
I appreciate that. I mean, the thing is, the Serbian film goes to it takes it to the end of horror. It's like, okay, we've now seen the worst thing that you can think of, which is newborn porn. And I kind of draw the analogy in the book. I always think, like, with metal, if I get philosophical, the first era of heavy metal, in my mind, goes from the first Black Sabbath album to Rain in Blood by Slayer.
Okay, yeah.
It's like, okay, so Slayer finished it. It's like, okay, everything after this is going to be part of something else. And I kind of feel that way with a Serbian film, which is not a masterpiece on par with, like, Texas Chainsaw Massacre or anything, but it is the definitive end of extreme horror and the beginning of something else.
Yeah,
I could agree with that.
I would agree with that, too, because right around that time had been the whole French explosion had just kind of finished, and then this Serbian film came out after that.
Right.
And I feel like the only thing that's come out after Serbian film that is kind of tops it, but to some people it may not, is Human Centipede. But that actually might be almost the same year, maybe.
It's around the same time.
It's around the same time, right, exactly.
Yeah, it was like some weak tea, man. It was like
yeah,
a lot of suggestion, a lot of, you know. I have always hated the idea that people will say, you know, like, I don't like gore. It's what you don't see that's scary. It's like, listen,
that's
fucko. I paid my money. Show me the fucking slaughter. So it's like, the Serbian film, I was like, I want to see shit eating. I want to see, you know, horrible stuff. I don't want the suggestion of it. So, and it seemed like, that seemed like a silly movie for, like, people who wanted to scandalize themselves. Like, can you believe we watched them?
Yeah, I can see that. I can see it. It made the rounds. I mean, you know, it was referenced in mainstream everything. Yeah,
pop culture phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah. What else?
There's much to admire in that, in getting that idea out into, you know, jokes on the Simpsons and everything.
Oh yeah, the Simpsons reference.
Yeah, they gave it. Yeah, that's amazing.
Sort of what comes to mind when I think of a Serbian film was that French movie, Martyrs. You know, very, like, there's like a higher concept with that film as well as a Serbian film, you know? And like,
yeah, I mean, Martyrs, to me, is a masterpiece on par with the greats. It was a movie I did not enjoy, and I thought was, I was feeling annoyed while I was watching it, but it really stayed with me.
Yeah.
And I really thought about the ideas that were going on.
Yeah.
For days on end afterwards. And then I went back and watched it again, and I was like, no, this really is one of the great, great horror films.
The ending.
There's a lot to think about with that movie. There's a lot, there's cosmic ideas going on there.
Yeah, I remember I watched that.
It's horrible to watch. It is awful.
Yeah, I've only watched it once, and I think about watching it again because I do want to watch it again, but I have yet to watch it again.
Right.
Yeah, I remember when I watched that in the afternoon one day, and it was like, okay, I'm gonna check this movie out. How bad, you know, how intense can it be? And then once the movie was done, I was like, okay, well, that's the end of my day, man. Like, I don't know what else I'm going to do with myself. I feel horrible. you know, like, maybe I'll just play with my cat or something. I don't know. Like, that's, you know, like, go to sleep. I don't know. But that was like, definitely something that stayed with me, and I still think about it, too. And that was, like, years ago when I saw it. So how does Deep Throat fit into the whole equation of a heavy metal movie?
It's a German thrash band called Deep Throat.
Oh, wow, okay.
The name of their album is The Devil and Miss Jones.
Holy shit.
Like 1980 or thereabout.
Oh,
it's also, you know, the idea that heavy metal is kind of, again, talking about the end of something. It's the end of rock and roll outlawism. You know, it's like, this is the end. It's, as Ian Christie, who published the book, the great Ian Christie, in his book, Bazillion Points, says, you know, rock would always just be heavy metal's more tame little brother after metal came around.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, you know, Deep Throat pushed cinema to an end. It became a mainstream hit with, you know, Double Penetration and Deep Throat blowjobs. So
yeah.
To me, that parallels metal, that it is like taking the most extreme form of art and serving it up in a way that the public, to various degrees, can grasp it.
Hmm. Right on. So how did you hook up with Bazillion Points? You know, they're a great company. I mean, you know, we both have, you know, a bunch of their material that they published over the years.
Well, it's a weird story. The direct way that I hooked up with them was I was a fan of their books.
Right.
And I befriended Ian Christie, who's the head of the company, on Facebook. And one day he wrote to me and said, there's a movie in my head, and I know you're going to know what it is, and I've never been able to identify it. He says, a woman is in a kitchen, like a 1950s kitchen, and she fucks the guy on the cream of wheat box. And the black dude on the cream of wheat box comes to life and fucks her. And then a piece of toast comes out and plays a saxophone.
What?
I said, that's Reach Dreams, 1981 masterpiece, Night Dreams.
Huh.
It's a great surrealistic porno film.
It
became a cult movie on its own from the guy that went on a year later to make Cafe Flesh, which is the great porn midnight movie crossover. And so, I mean, like, I had it for him in a second.
Hmm.
And then we just kind of became friends from there.
That's pretty great.
You know, I was really looking forward to the book Destroy All Movies, the history of punks and film.
Mm-hmm.
And that book came out in, I think, late 2010. And I went to Quimby's, which is our, like, fantastic zine shop, underground literature bookstore here. And I'm looking at the book. I'm like, this is a fucking masterpiece. I'm like, I got to write the heavy metal answer book to this.
Oh, okay.
So I took the book home. And, like, I announced it to Liz Mason, who runs Quimby's. Like, was there. I was like, Liz, here's what I'm doing. I'm telling you so that I can tell somebody. I'm writing them. I'm going to pitch the answer book to Bazillion Points. And hopefully they're going to go for it. So I went home, did that. It took a month or so, but I heard back from me, and then they gave me the thumbs up, and we went from there.
Awesome.
So the weird part of this is that Ian and I came up from the same kind of zine music world in New York in the early 90s, to the point that we know we were at the same party, like standing next to people in the same conversation that we never met. And weirder still is that in the 90s, I pitched a book about teen sex comedies and almost got it published at the same time that he pitched a book about teen sex comedies and almost got it published.
Huh.
And now our next project, the next book I'm writing for Bazillion Points, finally, 20 years later, is going all the way, The Ultimate Guide to Teen Sex Comedies.
Oh, great.
Nice.
Awesome. I expect a very nice Last American Virgin chapter.
Oh, please, yeah.
That's the number one. That might be my number one, yeah.
Yeah. Do you know that's based on a series of Israeli films called Lemon Popsicle?
That I did not know. Wow.
Yeah, well, you'll learn about that and more.
Yeah. Very cool. Yeah, I mean,
that's a remake of these bizarre Israeli sex comedies for kids. And yes, it's cool.
mindfulness, but it's such a world, and it's kind of connected to the metal stuff because it's all, you know, of the same era. We're all, I'm 46. This is the stuff I watched either in theaters or at home on VHS.
Yeah, I mean, I'm 41. I mean, I totally, you know, watched those movies growing up, and then they disappeared, and then they came back about 10 years ago. So I imagine, you know, the American Pies will be included.
Yeah, I'm the same age.
I'm just going to cover the 70s and 80s.
Oh, okay, cool. That's fine.
Yeah, you and I are the same age, Mike, so that's right in that same theater-going vibe, you know. Though I didn't go, I didn't live in New York City when I was a kid, but you know, probably saw the same movies for the most part.
Of course, yeah.
You know. So is there a place online where, you know, people, new fans can get a hold of you, you know, Twitter, Facebook, all that stuff?
My Twitter is McBeardo, at McBeardo. I have a website, McBeardo.com, that is being renovated now, but that'll be the outpost for all things Mike McBeardo McPadden going forward.
Right on. So what's the lowdown on this new book? Is it, you know, sometime to, you know, next year or
June 2016?
Okay, great.
Now, so
awesome. We'll keep an eye out, and when it comes out, we'll have you back on.
Yeah,
I
definitely
can't wait. That'll be great. Thank you so much.
All right, Mike. Thanks a lot.
Terrific. Take care.
Take care now.
Great fun.